Session number 28759, reel number 6.
So what are your memories then of this campaign? It was pretty vicious and...
Well, it's the first time I'd, you know... wonder if we were going to get out of it. But we did.
I mean, what do you remember of that?
How lucky I was. We had three batteries. I was in 50s. I was CPO 50s, Command Post Officer of 50s. And we had a dugout and a command post on the ground. We had the two troops of guns. We fired a lot. Two twos, residency battery. They were very near us. And 56, and it was very unfortunate. For one day, when the battle was on at Anzio, and we had a mortar battery in front of two twos, and they got shelled. We used to get a sort of fighter bomber come over and drop bombs, and they come out of the sun. And this mortar battery started a fire one morning, and this in front of two twos, and this bomber came over, and it hit the command post, which meant then all the radio and the direct fire direction people in that particular area were wounded or killed. And it applied to the other battery as well, 5-6. The one I was in, 2-2s, we didn't get hit. We were able to keep firing on me, and because there was quite a strong attack coming on. But then that was the day I... it was February... 44. I was in the I command post, and because of the casualties we had in the other place, the colonel, I had a colonel on the phone, and he said, I wanted to go over to 2-2 residency battery and take over A troop, which I did, because
it's here, yeah.
Captain Evans, King, and so on, Smith.
Yep, so you took over.
So I made a captain, and I took... Peter Rupin was my second in command, and he got a... He took over my my job at the battery there. Terrible, I can't remember the date sometimes. Fly over bridge. We had a good OP there. We had a wonderful view of everything, you see. And they were lost on this day. They lost a lot of loot. He got an MC that day, Peter Rippman, because he rallied the troops, because I mean, he hadn't got anybody left alive, I think, in the command post, and he, how collected chap he was. That's right, yeah. He had to support the OPs in rotation, and Tom Heald, who's we used to have to send three tanks up with the infantry in very exposed positions, and we'd done that several times. And Tom Heath, he was in his tank, and they brought up one of the German tanks, and he was killed because they got his tank there. And so I was sort of promoted and taken out, took over his troop.
So this was a time of very confused fighting? It was very fast-moving and...
Well, no, it was very static, because we were static. We couldn't go backwards, because we'd be in the sea. And, no, it was a major counter-attack, and everything got pretty hectic, because we were losing casualties and so on. But we had various reinforcements came along, and we had a lot more guns than the Germans. We had terrific a number. We were able to concentrate the artillery. We had masses, and the Americans had too. And we did a lot of firing, and the Germans had so many casualties they couldn't continue the attacks. And eventually they had to move backwards.
So you took the flyover, that was then...
Flyover bridge, had a very good view. We had two tunnels dug, the engineers, two tunnels. First of all, first time they did one was a straight tunnel. And they didn't twig what they were doing. They didn't have blankets to, because the Germans could see perfectly where it was. They used to put the armour-piercing shells down the OP's. But after a bit, we had kinks in the thing and had machine guns in there. And but at night, we used to have to come out and cross the railway line, the ridge, walk over and to the infantry, because I used to go over there at night to be with the company commander and battalion commanders who were in the slit trenches on the other side of the road. We used to give them help them out and give them some fire there.
How do you mean, give them some fire? What, you'd go over there?
I'd go, yes, instead of him having to come over to me, or we had phones there, or radio.
So you'd relay back instructions to your guns? And
yes, we had radios. We had a radio and a tank and everything, just to keep them on the blink. And then we used to call down fire. And I could... We had liaison and officers in the next division. We had the 1st Division, the 45th, 33rd, we had four divisions with artillery. And we had one of our chaps, troop commanders, with his tank would go to the divisional dugout and be there with the officer commander of the division.
And so you'd fire, and you'd fire from that point?
Yeah, and you'd give him to, you know, where we want, he wanted it put down, you see. And we could have massive firepower. That's what saved our bacon there.
If you moved a gun into a position like that, wouldn't that then run the risk of returning fire locating you and all the troops around
well,
you?
Well, it's quite difficult, as I said. Yes, you've got counter-battery work and so on, and you get pinpointed, but we had quite a lot of camouflage and stuff about it. It wasn't all that easy. And we were lucky in the sense that at Anzio we had air superiority. We had the advantage of air OP. As soon as we put up what we call a schufte kite, the Germans would stop firing because they didn't want to be spotted. It was much easier from a plane to spot them. And that stopped the firing very often.
Well, shall we... So, any more to say about the flyover bridge, or shall we go on then to Anzio? I mean, when that was...
Well, we attacked through there. I've got a copy of my colleague. He was with the leading battalion, and they had to fire. They mentioned it here. Yes, I was with this lot here. I was pulled out at Anzio to go with a fellow called Colonel Howes, which is a task force of tanks. When we'd broken through on the right of the bridgehead, and I joined him there, and we was sort of, we had about 30 tanks, and we literally broke out of the bridgehead, went through the German lines, and into Rome, along by the Alban Hills.
And these were all British?
And it was the day of the Normandy landings, actually. On June the 6th.
Sorry, we seem to have lost a couple of months, though, didn't we? Because we had...
The flyover, yes. But this was... we were then still in Anzio. We were there for quite a long time. From January through to June.
But not fighting all the time?
No, firing defensive things, because the Germans didn't attack all the time. They used to have periods when they built up enough strength to have another go, and we'd have to reinforce it. We did attacking as well, because we wanted to get out of the show.
And this was the time you mentioned earlier when you had nurses coming up for tea because the gun lines were quieter. Can you tell me a little bit what it was like to be in this?
Well, they were getting... they were getting shelled at night.
The hospital areas?
Yeah, well, they couldn't help, you know. They were German, often bombed occasionally, and they were having eyes. We were seeing a horrible time. And they were, because it wasn't very far. They come up. And they came up one day for tea, and they didn't ever fire any guns. They wanted to, I think. Well, it was, they had a rough time, I think, of all of them. It was the first time, you see, where we were in a static position. They all lived in dugouts, and you know, it's pretty horrible when you're in that sort of situation. But you get used to that. And safer.
It mentions in the book there was fraternization between frontline troops in these conditions, because they were often...
Well, the end of 43.
We were talking about conditions in Anzio, that's right. And
yeah.
The first time, and we're talking about fraternization. I mean, it says in your regimental report there that there was fraternization. Well, it mentions it there. I mean, or in the other book, I think. Oh, no, sorry, that newspaper cutting of that Telegraph review of a book written by it about that time, how the conditions in Anzio were so, or almost like the First World War.
Oh, yes, they were.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I was quite comfortable in the flyover. I had a tank at the back of the flyover. Once we'd cleaned it all up, the Americans, I never thought, but we were rather house proud of our conditions. Americans used to leave all their V-ration cans all over the place, so when you trod in the dark at night, there was a lot of clattering and banging. But anyway, that was a minor point. Isn't it? No, we liked their rations. They had much better coffee than we did. They didn't have all this stupid tea, milk and sugar and the same thing. So they always had decent coffee. And... had various different rations too. It was quite nice to get something different to eat. And even when they were static, it took a bit of getting used to the American rations. They had a proper cookhouse, or you even neglected your dining things, and you'd very often get bacon and peaches all on one plate. It didn't seem to mind, but it was just a minor thing. Glad to get them home. But, I used to get on with them very well. They were good, they were very good fellows. They were a bit gung-ho. You see, the British Army, had to account for everything. And even my revolver, I had a 38 revolver. I only used it once. I fired one bullet out of it. And because I fired one bullet out of it, I had to make an indent right back to division that I'd fired one bullet. I shot a dog because it had trodden a mine and lost one leg, two legs. It was just outside room. And so we accounted for our ammunition. And every night you had to count for it, you know. Same as everything, you know, the kit, like your kit in a barrack, you know, all laid out, and when you had it inspected, as an officer, you had to make sure that they had got all their kit. If it was usually put out when you had barracks, you see, the blankets and everything, and the socks and the things and everything, and then three pairs of socks, army, one in the wash, one on view. And the American worried too much about that.
What about those kind of conditions when you were actually in Anzio? I mean, you weren't doing inspections then.
No. We just looked after ourselves, and virtually the blokes were pretty good at it. You know, there was this army vehicle cooking. They all helped each other out.
How would that work if you, say, on one tank? How would you share the cooking duties?
Well, you weren't riding in the tank all the time by any means. I mean, you stopped at night and so on and so forth, and you allocated the same old business. I mean, my crew was a chap called my assistant, OP, who was conversant with the radio and could direct fire when I wasn't available, and a chap called Slaney. He stayed on in the army. He went out to Korea. We used to meet in a pub after the war. He was with the Americans in Korea, and it was crazy. I mean, I thought it was pretty crazy before. Extraordinary. And he didn't think much of the Americans in Korea, I don't think. And he was very useful. He was one of the crew. And so we used to take it in turns cooking, you see. It's like that old story all the time. You know, they used to have different ideas about what to do with the food. What to do with bully beef when you were down to bully beef and tinned meat. I'm very good at fritters, bully beef fritters. Anything to make a bit of difference. And we were mad about cabbages. I remember in a place on Italy called Comana in Bagno, when we were with the Polish later on, after Anzio, we were the Poles. And we were going down through a village and saw there were some cabbages in the chap's garden. So we negotiated. I think we did a trade with cigarettes and we had cabbages. It was like nectar. I mean, you had to cook a cabbage. Things, I mean, you know, made what you could out of it all. I had the other gunner in the front, was a chap called O'Hagan. His mother and father were in prison in England, they were all IRA. And Peter, my commander, he used to say, "Can't you do anything about O'Hagan? He's the scruffiest man in the battery." I said, "No, he's the bravest man in the battery. He was bomb-proof, you know. He looked a bit scruffy, and I think it's like Wellington at Waterloo. I think he frightened me, he frightened the Germans." But he was wonderful. And you've got to have people who have, you know, if the lines get broken, the telephone lines, somebody's got to get up and go out there and get two ends of wine and wind them together, haven't they? And these sort of people do that, they don't think about it. Erskine was the driver mainly. He'd had, he was with my predecessor when he got the tank caught fire. He had to get out the front and put the fire out. He'd done that twice. and he's a Scotsman. Didn't say very much. Sometimes I couldn't understand what he said. He was a bloody good driver. And we went and joined up people. We used to be sent, because we were armoured artillery, to different people who were changing their equipment. We used to go and have to be sent along to show them, familiarise them with things like that. And this was the North Irish Horse, who were all cavalry fellows, very nice fellows from around northern Ireland. And they had Churchill tanks. And they had a terrible pasting at in the Leary Valley, just under Casino, where the Germans had 75 turrets from Panther tanks reinforced in the ground. And they used to clear the trees, so they had clear fire. And he showed me the cases when they were there. They lost 22 tanks in about an area the size of a tennis court, or a bit bigger than a football pitch. And anyway, we were on manoeuvres with them to practice. And I was given a Churchill tank instead of the Sherman. That's the OP tank, and Erskine, he'd never driven one before, but he got the chap to show him how to do it and all that sort of stuff. And we then went and with him, he was driving. But Shermans, we could do a lot with a Sherman. They were very tough, really. They were good road things. They went fast. They had strong tracks. And when I was with Miss Churchill, we were in sort of just manoeuvring, really, to find an OP. And I went along on a normal stretch, and we came to a ditch, which was the Sherman. We would have just come on ahead and done this. I said, Erskine, carry on, we're going okay. He couldn't see sometimes properly. And go on down, you went across this ditch and the bloody track came off. And that's how reliable the Churchill was sometimes, or unreliable. And British tanks all over the period, if you read some of the histories of some of the squadrons and some of the battalions, they were unreliable. The engines broke down and things like that, mainly because we hadn't had enough practice in improving them. And some of them were rather thick-skinned, some of them undergunned. You read some of the stories in the desert. You know, they've got to move in another 1,000 yards with their particular gun in order to get a hit on a Mark III German Panzer tank.
You had Shermans. You'd been equipped with Shermans by now, hadn't you?
Shermans, yeah, but we didn't have a gun on it.
No,
we had a machine gun. Yes, but the British Army generally was Sherman. Yeah, I think in thing I read about, the Corn battles and D-Day in France, they were practically all Shermans. But the trouble with the Sherman was, it was very unsuited to the country where they were. I can never understand this. The country where they landed was just like Cornwall. High hedges, roads in behind hedges. And it was a piece of cake for the Germans defending.
But I mean, you said, you were just looking at a minute ago at the record there, and you said we were re-equipped with Sherman tanks after...
Honey tanks, we call them. Well, mainly because a honey tank was... small turret, and we had casualties with those as OP tanks. They were very, very fast, but the Sherman was a good tank for an OP tank.
What are the qualities of an OP tank? It's got to be better protected, and
yes, because you haven't got a gun. You've got two machine guns. Two machine guns. You've got .5s and the 37mm, but you weren't there to fight the tank as a tank. You were there to help who you were with heavy artillery or artillery. So you wanted to be in a good position so you could see things, and the Sherman tank was pretty good like that. It was quite tall. It was one of its problems. It was difficult to hide it, but it was useful. You could see things out of it. And it was reliable. Diesel one was.
So, I think...
Where we got to? We got to the end.
We got to the end of Anzio. You're just making the breakout now from Anzio. Mm-hmm. Is there anything more you'd like to say about Anzio? I know it's a fairly important battle. I mean, it is...
It was, really. It was the key to that bit in Italy. It was very slow. I mean, we were there to help Cassino. If we'd been able to move on ahead and occupy the Alban Hills, we would have dominated the road back to Cassino, and the Germans would have had to have retired. Otherwise, they'd be in our pocket, wouldn't they? But that didn't happen. And we were stuck at Anzio, and they were stuck at Cassino, and we had appalling casualties there. We had about four battles at Cassino, the Indians and the Poles and the British. Eventually, really, it was relieved because the 8th Army came the other side of Cassino.
And went round it. Let's go back to... So you make this break, you break out. It's a bridgehead.
Anyway, went into Rome.
You went into Rome unopposed? How did that happen?
No, there was various sniping from flats and things like that. I was closed down and we turned the tank over, actually, because we were all closed down. Three of us did.
What happened? I mean, it's quite an important moment, really, driving into Rome. Can you tell me about that?
Well, we went off and it was soft ground.
No, but I mean, the getting out of the bridgehead, going through, this must...
Well, they were in a place called Centocelle. There were blocks of flats. And the Germans were there and we had machine guns in. But it was only minor stuff. And mainly we were helping the civvies, because the civvies were all over the place and were occupying the roads. And we got in from the south. We actually passed the Colosseum. And that's as far as we went.
Do you remember the date? I'm just looking for the date.
June 44.
Were you surprised at how easy it was to do the breakout?
Yeah, I was, actually. When I was talking about ammunition, this is a funny thing now with his tanks and things like that. Colonel Howes' tank, we basically went along. When we stopped and it got dark and we couldn't see anything, we had a couple of bulldozer tanks with us, so we ploughed out a section and we had formed a lager around the area. And the colonel in his headquarters, they used that as a deep way of protection from bombs. We had a few bombs still, mostly from our own side. The most important thing you had when you're on the show like that is yellow smoke. Yellow smoke was supposed to indicate... I don't know why the Germans never triggered. We were using yellow smoke, and why they didn't use yellow smoke, I don't know. But as soon as we heard a plane, whether it was one of ours or one of theirs, we used to chuck their smoke out as soon as possible, once we were on the move to get out of the way. And that was most important. We used to, one of the jokes they used to have, there seemed to be an awful lot of friendly fire. I never called it very friendly fire.
Graham Rowntree, Reel 7.
But, uh,